This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good afternoon.
And to John and Linda joining us on Zoom, thank you for being here. So we finished one day of sitting. How's it going, anybody? Want to say anything or ask anything about Sasheen so far? Yes.
Maybe a few words about Tenkui, what it means. I mean, I know transmission of light, but what is the root of it, or what does that mean?
What does?
Tenkui.
That's about all I know. It's one of the four main sesshins we hold every year, and sesshin is also a gathering of our light, where we gather, because we each are light. And as you said yesterday, to receive is to transmit. That's also said in one of the sutras. So it's usually for us a teaching sesshin and a work one too. Like in the autumn, grasshoppers get ready. Maybe, I don't know if grasshoppers get ready for winter, is it? But the ants do, and we have laughing squirrels. I think they're laughing at us. What are you doing? It's about all I know. So, Sasheen is really considered extraordinary to partake in sesshin. Though we do it several times a year, it's still just the great teachers talk about it just being extraordinary time. And it's also a difficult time because when we view the schedule, it looks onerous. Or at least the part of us that looks at the schedule and criticizes it sees it as onerous. That's the ego talking. It's like, well, what? And really the best way to approach sesshin is to let the schedule do you and just show up for the schedule and just do it as best you can. One of the qualities of sesshin that happens when you persist with it is you get to really meet yourself in some uncomfortable ways. For me, it's often physical. I'm used to being comfortable. I'm used to not being in pain. And I'm used to being able to lie down when I want and things like that. But there's, in taking the pose, the upright pose, whether sitting on a cushion, sitting in a chair, I guess even standing, walking, lying down too, it's a chance to meet our, how we are, and then though you mentioned yesterday, Ekuro, that you don't have many questions. It seems like there are fewer questions these days. I was thinking about that maybe it's because we're questioning constantly. It's like, well, what's going on now? What was that? You know, we're actually, these questions are present. It's just the discerning questions, many of the other questions don't arise so much, or maybe they do in this space that we, the 30 minutes, the 40 minutes, we face a wall. There's a lot that erupts, and we get to notice it and be with it. And being with it for a duration actually provides an opportunity to meet it in ways maybe we haven't before. So just, I just want to encourage you to persist through this, because it's work that can only be done by each one of us. And you can't, though we have these teachings and teachers that before us helped us, the core purpose of Sesshin is realization, and to realize is to experience, and to experience is to taste. And so that's why we come together to do this, to realize self and realize what goes into self, and the vastness of self, and the interconnectedness of self. And the further you dig into where the self is, good luck in finding it. My older brother told me, he was always messing with me, and he said, do you know what the difference between a pessimist and an optimist is? You know, they were, at that age, they were kind of new words to me. I said, no. And he said, well, a pessimist is this boy that goes into a room full of toys, and just every toy you can imagine is in there. And he looks at the toys and he goes, well, I think the other boy is having more fun than I am. And then the other boy is put in a room full of horse manure. And the person checking on him went in and said, how are you doing? He says, well, you know, where there's manure, horse manure, there's going to be a pony. I'm looking. And that's been my bent most of my life, is digging in the stuff. And today, well, is there anything else anybody wants to bring up about Sesshin before I go on? Okay. Well, today I'm going to read from this, parts of this. And please. Mahamati was an extraordinary bodhisattva. And he says to the Buddha, the Bhagavan, he says, my name is Mahamati. To plumb the depths of the Mahayana, I come before the peerless one with 108 questions. And the Bhagavan says, ask your questions, son of victors. And son of victors or daughters of victors are bodhisattvas. Ask and I will explain. So I just want to, maybe some of you already looked at these questions, some of these questions, but I just want to read them slowly and just kind of sit with it. Questions can be mind expanding sometimes. And I just, sometimes we don't know what questions to ask. And here are some questions. So Mahamati asks, how is thinking purified? Where does thinking come from? How should we regard delusion? Where does it come from? Why are there lands and apparitions, attributes and other paths? Why are there stages of practice and freedom from projection? And what does the daughter of victor mean? Where does liberation lead? Who is bound and who is freed? What are the realms of meditation? And why are there three paths? How does causation work? What is a cause or an effect? Why say they are different, and where do they come from? What are the formless meditations? What is cessation of perception? After all perception ceases, how does awareness arise from trance? How do effects come about? How do we control our body? How do we see what we see? Where do stages come from? Who breaks through all three realms? In what place and body, and where are they born? And why are there bodhisattvas? How are higher powers gained? How are masteries and samadhis gained? Tell us, victor of victors, what is the mind in samadhi like? What is repository consciousness? The will and conceptual consciousness. How do they arise and cease, and what makes sensations stop? What constitutes a lineage? Or no lineage, or nothing but mind? How are attributes acquired? What does no self mean? How could there be no beings? And why teach conventional truths? How do we put an end to views of eternity or annihilation? Why do the Buddhas and other teachers not look different from each other? And why in future ages will there be different sects? What is the cause of emptiness? What does momentary mean? Where does a womb come from? Why does the world not shake? How is the world like a dream or illusion? A city of Gandharvas, which are celestial musicians. How is a seasonal mirage or moonlight on the water like a dream or illusion? Why speak of aids to enlightenment or elements of awareness? What causes chaos in a kingdom? Does belief in existence exist? Why does the world not arise or cease? Why does the world not arise or cease? How is it like a flower in the sky? How do we know about the world if you say it transcends language? What is freedom from projection like? How is it like the sky? How many kinds of suchness are there? How many kinds of consciousness or paramitas are there? How do we progress through stages? Who gets free from projections? What are the two kinds of no self? And how do we purify knowledge? How many kinds of knowledge are there? How many kinds of moral codes or beings are there? Who created precious things, such things as gems and pearls? Who invented languages and the different kinds of beings? Who was it who revealed fields of knowledge and technique? How many forms of poetry are there? What about prose and meter? How many kinds of logic are there, and what constitutes an explanation? Where do food and drink come from? What gives rise to sexual desire? What constitutes a king, a minor regent, or a kakravatan? How do they protect their realms, and how many kinds of deities are there? What is meant by earth, the sun and moon and stars? How many kinds of liberation are there? How many kinds of practitioners? How many kinds of disciples? What constitutes a master? How many kinds of Buddhas are there? How many lives do they live? How many kinds of demons exist? How many heterodox teachings are there? How many modes of reality are there? How many kinds of mind? Please tell me, best of speakers, what does mere designation mean? Why are elephants and horses and deer trapped and caught by men? O charioteer of the mind, why are some people despised? Why do we observe six seasons? Why are there Ichantikas? How do males and females and androgens come to be? Why do some adepts regress? Why do some advance? How do meditation masters teach, and what kind of people do they train? What are the marks and attributes of beings born in different realms? And what constitutes material wealth, and how is it acquired? How did the Shakyas come to be? Who was the ascetic sage, and what was it that he taught? How does the Tathagata appear in every time and place, surrounded by bodhisattvas of different names and likenesses? Why shouldn't we eat meat? Why is meat proscribed? Why are there carnivorous beings, and why do they eat meat? Why are lands and kingdoms shaped like the sun and moon? Sumara or a lotus flower, or a swastika or lion? Why are lands and kingdoms shaped like Indra's net, overturned above us, composed of countless jewels? Why are there male and female trees, Karitaki and Amali groves, Mount Kailash and Iron Ring, Diamond Summit and the other peaks? And why are all these mountains adorned with countless jewels, rishis and gandharvas? Please tell us why this is. I jumped a bunch of some of the questions. So, I mean, I didn't even realize there were that many questions to ask. But it just opens up a lot of possibilities of where knowledge can be and go and what it's contained. So after hearing all these gathas on the teaching of the Mahayana, on the heart of every Buddha, the knower of worlds, then answered, well, and ably asked, now listen, Mahamati, the questions you have raised, I will answer one by one. Now this is for the next two pages, he doesn't answer the questions, but he repeats every question. He says, he starts off, as for birth and no birth, nirvana, emptiness and moments, rebirth and no self-existence, Buddhas and paramitas, and Shravakas, Pratikabuddhas and Bodhisattvas, the formless practice of other schools, Sumeru and seas and mountains, continents and other lands. He goes on to just keep repeating every aspect of his questions. The extinction and psychic travel, aids and elements of enlightenment, meditations and boundless states, transmigration and the skandhas. And I'm going to go to the end of his... And He says, today I will reveal truths that transcend words. While I list them one by one, listen well, you bodhisattvas, to these 108 statements as spoken by Buddhas of the past. A statement about birth is about no birth. A statement about permanence is about no permanence. A statement about characteristics is about no characteristics. A statement about passion is about no passion. A statement about desire is about no desire. A statement about skill is about no skill. A statement about purity is about no purity. So I'll stop here. I just like to hear what effect the questions might have had. Curtis?
It feels like the culmination of all the questions that happened in Sesshin.
Yeah. Tim?
You alluded earlier to how we're at a level of asking questions here. This is my first time here. You know, do I go right here or do I go left here? And all those questions. You know, where do I put my whatever? Those all have an answer, a simple answer. I just have to ask you. But all those questions are really good questions that, like, they don't have an answer, it seems. But they kind of broaden the mind. Being here, I was saying, it sort of feels like I'm in a foreign country. And I've been in a foreign country where I've had to try to formulate what's the right question to ask, you know, that really gets me to where I need to go. And I've been thinking about that. But here you pose these questions that, poof, you know, do they really have an answer? It's sort of a whole level, whole another level of asking.
And exploration.
The no self. What is the no self? Can you do what the no self is?
I'm looking at it. Can you see yourself? No self is no fixed, enduring self. That's just, we're composed of parts that are pretty fluid. Existence is sometimes talked about as like a stream that becomes a waterfall, and our lives are each droplet as it falls, individualized, but then it flows back into the big stream, into the small stream or big stream. And there are individual distinctions, but the duration of those don't last long, even for us older guys. You know, it's like, how was it when I was a kid? And am I the same person now? It's in kind of the same body that keeps going, but When I was a kid, I was full of questions. And I really annoyed my dad. Because I'd ask question after question after question, and then he could tell I wasn't listening to the answer. So at one point he finally said, I said, "Why, Dad, why?" And he said, "Well, it's for little boys to ask questions." And that kind of shut me up. But this insatiable curiosity that I had no way to even, I didn't even have a vessel for to collect the what he had to tell me. And so it just kept, it was empty, always asking. And now you touched on something yesterday, Judy, where these questions, I'm not full of questions anymore. It's not that I know necessarily, but it's maybe it's a different stage of questioning. And then I realized that, you know, I'm questioning all the time, you know, like, how am I doing? Where, how am I, how's my posture? What am I feeling? What's going on? What's that sound? You know, so there's always these questions always arising for me. The footnotes in here are just wonderful from Red Pine and delving into the meaning of many of these words. And I can see why you could study it, go through it four times over 10 years. It's just vast, and still find new. Don?
Yeah, there's so many questions. And at first listening to them being read, for me, it was almost mind-boggling. But yet, there's so many, many more, and there's no end to them. The thought occurred to me, you know, there's always going to be more questions, but what I got from this is they all have the same answer. And thank goodness for the Heart Sutra, because it keeps bringing it back down to, well, no form, nothing to attain, no impurity, no. And you could probably recite the Heart Sutra for every one of those questions. About that. So it kind of goes back to what was being discussed the other day with conceptualization when we were kicking off the introduction to this and everything. And it's not what we think. It's, the thoughts are themselves, there's no thought. They're empty. So I take comfort in that sometimes.
Thanks, Don. Mike?
Well, asking a why question is kind of frivolous because there are no answers to why questions. I mean, I'm a scientist, you never ask a why question. If you ask a why question as a freshman, they're going to throw the book at you. You know, because you can't answer a why question. You know, it has to have some kind of sequence of logic to it or something. And of course, we all ask, why is the sky blue? Why does this happen? Or the physicists, what's the beginning of the universe? What's the Big Bang? Well, they're going to find out that when they open that box, it's going to be another universe. When they open that box, it's going to be another universe. And it's just going to be these infinite. In some respects, you're just spinning your wheels, right? Asking those kind of questions. Because they don't provoke. There's not an answer. There's not an answer. Like, why are there two sexes and androgynies? I guess you could say because evolution worked that way. I don't know. I find it frustrating when they kept asking these questions that have, honestly, just no answer in my mind. There's no answer to these questions because I think they're asking the wrong question. most things. I think it's so important to ask the right question.
What would be a right question?
That's a good, I don't know what the right question is. What the nature of reality? What is the nature of reality? Where do you want to start? At what level? At what? The atomic level? The species level? What's, I don't know. I don't know how to ask that question. But I could hear these questions, and I could hear every single question did not have an answer. Honestly, every question that was asked don't have answers. They don't have an answer. Maybe that's the point. Maybe they can't be answered.
Some of these questions do have answers. Like, there are stages, there are progressions in on the path. Just like there are stages and progressions in growing and in organisms growing. So there are things to point to. There are understandings that can come about. Would you like to say anything about my question?
I would just agree with you relatively. A lot of them, what is the repository consciousness? I mean, somebody could tell you in the Yogacara tradition what the repository consciousness is. What are the modes of reality? So some of them do, and I think the value is the pointing. It's go into that, see what that is. But for me, it's the attitude of a questioner that is so important. That just that whatever your question is, you're opening your out. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I would ask, like, I'll create a question, like, what's the nature of reality? How?
Both existence and non-existence is the nature of reality. So it's all right available. You know, each of us are vessels. Each of us are like vases. And Lex Hickson wrote about Kaveh. Some of you know Kaveh. And he brought up about Lex Hickson, who actually, I think, in his life, he converted to Islam. He died 40 years ago as a young guy. And he translated some things, and he one of his books in the Buddhist tradition is The Mother of All the Buddhas, Mahaprajnaparamita, and it's extraordinary. Going into the background of the mother of the Buddhas. But he, with his background, he didn't talk about Buddha nature. That wasn't part of his lexicon that he shared. He called it open mind. We're all with it. The open mind of the entire universe is available to each of us because we're a vessel. And just like a vase holds the atmosphere, a broken vase is still in the middle of the atmosphere. So it's... there's so much to experience, and to know with certainty is there are times when you can know with certainty. If you stopped after the white line where there's a stop sign and a policeman caught you, he took a picture, there's certainty you're past that. You know, you get that nice ticket for some revenue enhancement. For whatever municipality gets in. And there's certainty in that too, in the ticket and when it's due. Tim?
Hand raised online.
Yes, John, hi. Thanks for joining us from St. Paul.
Thank you for having me. Well, it might not seem related, or maybe it will, but when I think about something like block sitting and so on, a question I wonder about is, do you wonder about hip and knee replacement and the height of the zafu? Like if you see like Mel Weitzman, he used to have that really skinny zafu and he could sit cross-legged until the end of his life. And then you see like Kwong Roshi, he had a pretty high zafu and now he sits in a chair. And I don't know when Angie Roshi at all, but I don't know, like, do you think about like, how is it when somebody is sitting time and again, and they're wearing their body out and trying to be careful about it? Like, what's the best way to use it up and stuff like that? So that kind of comes to mind.
That's a relevant Sasheen question. I wondered about that all my sitting life. Because it felt like when I first started sitting with Katagiri Roshi that my knees were wearing out. And I thought, well, I'll do one more Sasheen. And maybe I won't be able to get up off the cushion or walk again. But every Sasheen, I can get up off the cushion and walk again, which means I have to sit another Sasheen. Do you have any suggestions? I mean, we got to take care of our bodies. And I remember Blanche, when I was sewing with her about 12 years ago, and she used to be able to sit cross-legged, but then had to give it up at some point. But Mel was able to do it till he died, huh? So what's your point of your question?
Well, maybe the point of the question is something like, if I think I'm having a mind-only experience and I want to attribute problems that can be solved by my small mind, like I can just think it away or just change my attention or something like that, that mind would also include things like osteoporosis and arthritis and things that keep memory in a very deep way, so that after a while to say it's mind only, it doesn't maybe make any difference. Because mind as opposed to body, for example, okay, fine, body's an extension of mind and it breaks and has all kinds of problems too. After a while, if I'm saying chitta matra or whatever, like, do I end up saying anything worthwhile? Is there any worthwhile? What's worthwhile to that distinction when I start to include things like joints wearing out?
Well, it's body mind. They're one, body mind. And Beata Chapman, I don't know if you know her. She's a teacher in Darlene Cohen's lineage. And she runs a group called Suffering and Delight that Darlene also worked with before she passed 11 years ago. She talks about that our bodies actually receive like 7 times more information than we get in our brain, that our bodies hold memory and everything in way strong, bigger ways than our mind alone does. So separating body and mind is kind of hard to do. And people with trauma, their trauma is located in different parts of their body, and they can discover some aspects of trauma by investigating those locations in their body. So where our body ends is a whole nother thing. Does it end at the hair, tips of the hair on our skin and head? Or does it extend further than that? And when people, some people are prescient of auras that people have. So is the body mind at the edge of the aura? When a person is deeply connected to other people, there are times when someone at great distance has an affliction, and that deep connection is known, even though it's their people are thousands of miles apart. How is that? So where does body end? Where does mind end? And so to encapsulate it in this, in the cranium, or even limit it to this body, I don't know, maybe it's superfluous to even talk about trying to investigate that, but to the boundlessness of our experience is what we get to taste from time to time. And that is realization. You know, when we actually taste that, it's like, wow. And then it's over like that. That's back to what's going on? Why am I sitting here facing a wall or not facing a wall? And then that mind, the other part mind, kind of comes back to keep giving us trouble for a while because it's telling us what we need to look at, probably.
Just real quick, okay, it's physical, about physical questions, you know, physical body. Why do we sit this way and not this way? Is it just tradition? Or is there actually, like, when your eye sees a light, there's been some physiological studies that it takes 40 minutes for the brain to settle down back to baseline. Okay, so some people think that 40 minutes meditation is finally when your nervous system settles down from a perception. Is there actually a physiological basis to sitting cross-legged? Or are you really, why do we sit there? In full lotus, or whatever position we sit, is it just that's the way it started?
Well, it's people have been experimenting for a long, long time, and one factor of that helps. Those that have explored this path is there are postures that work and those that don't. And for those that can be upright, it works in certain ways. I know for me, this is purely anecdotal because I haven't done any other research except right here. Of sitting full lotus or half lotus has helped quell my mind. It works for me. And so this style has worked. For those that don't, it doesn't work to do that because of the physiology. There are other modes, like sitting on a stool, sitting seiza, sitting in a chair. In the priest training program I was in, the Shigako priest ongoing training spot, we had one woman who, an ordained priest, who would use abutants. She couldn't tolerate being upright, but that worked for her. So we're just exploring, and then we share as we go. Maybe when it's young monks at the temples in Japan, you can get these people with young bodies that are configured in certain ways to sit in ways, and then if you're not, you can get hit with a stick, you know. And it can turn out to be abusive, but Koban wouldn't do that when he was head of practice at Eheiji. The story is that you know, there was sometimes meanness in the use of the stick, and he had a real gentle way with the Westerners that came to sit at Eheiji in the 60s when he was head of practice there. And Suzuki Roshi heard about it and came and saw it and brought him. So he brought a gentler approach. So we're all discovering it. If you find other ways of sitting that help in this process, you know, bring it forward, please. Jiu-zan.
Jiu-zan. If the circularity always continues, what's the value of bringing it to the teacher? How does the teacher help us with that circularity?
Repeat your question.
Referring to that curiosity you were talking about in the question of Mahamati, it seems like, at least for me, that circularity doesn't go anywhere. I keep bringing it to the teacher and it just keeps showing up. So I wonder what's helpful about bringing that to the teacher.
You've heard these questions before. Was there anything new this time you heard them?
I didn't particularly remember them, but it feels familiar still. Like it's my own circularity showing up in Mahamati.
Were there any deeper senses about any of the questions that did come up, because you do have some experience now with practice and different kinds of meditation and different styles that you probably understood the questions a little bit. I mean, the first time you hear these questions, it's like, what's that? Gandharvas. What's a Gandharva? What's a Shravaka Buddha or a Pratika Buddha? You know, that sends me to the book or to online to find out what those are. And maybe it is circularity. Maybe it's more like the footprint of our passage through space. Our solar system is rotating, and as we're revolving through space, so there's a circularity both in the orbital aspect, but as that's happening, the universe is also, the Milky Way is rotating, And so the path that it leaves behind is like this of our whole solar system. And so there is, maybe it's just endless circularity is all we can do. And there is no resolution. But there are some ahas along the way. Has there been any ahas, any revelations that in the pursuit of these questions that have come?
I have another question about it.
Pardon me?
I have another question about it. What does that circularity show us about our minds or what we're trying to see? What is it pointing at?
But maybe that's how it is. There are patterns that repeat. You know, that's one of the ways we learn is when patterns tend to repeat, we say, aha, there's a pattern. I see that. And the next time I see it, it's like there again. Mm. You know, when you meet somebody and you notice something about their behavior that is pleasant or unpleasant, and then it happens again, and then it happens a third time, it's like, there's a pattern here, which indicates a circularity. And I think being familiar with these different patterns makes us more skillful. And also being seeing these patterns helps us to expand our tolerance, our resoluteness even, maybe expand our patience that these repeated patterns, it's like, there it is again. You know, you can just do that, but it could be, there it is again. I've had many patterns in my life that kept repeating, but in a different way, and it reminds me of it's kind of silly, mad comic book thing. You know, there was one of the series is this little kid is at a piano and he's banging away in the piano, and you know his parents think he's going to become a great pianist, and you know, and the next scene shows him trying to learn to play the piano, and the next scene something else, and it turns out he becomes a piano mover, you know? So patterns repeat, and it's important to see those in our lives, but they're also patterns that may indicate there are seeds of that the seeds. And then when you can see the actual seeds, some of the earlier causes of it on ourselves, maybe it gives us a chance to say, oh no, and it's not necessary anymore. Do you see patterns of repeating within you? I mean, you're seeing the circularity of some of these questions keep coming again and again.
For sure.
Does the level of intensity go up each time you ask it? Does the quality of the question remain the same each time?
Doesn't seem like it. Seems like there's variance.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot to explore. Even in repeating qualities. So
thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.